Good afternoon. This is the time of year when it's fun to go up country and take in the county fairs. They've changed a lot since I used to go, being more modern and glamorous. For my money, the sulky races at the Union Fair and Damascotti were far more exciting than these pari-mutuel affairs. And anyway, I prefer the smaller shows, like the one up in Tunbridge, Vermont, where whole families used to come in hayracks and bring their homemade exhibits. Why, I even won a blue ribbon at the Union Fair one time with an exhibition of unusual fruit, apples with pictures on them. I'd been making blueprints, and as I saw how the sun changed the color in the printing paper, I wondered if I couldn't do the same thing with a green apple. So I took a small negative of a three-masted schooner, climbed up my apple tree, and glued that film onto a big fat apple, Baldwin, I guess it was, and I cut off the surrounding leaves so it would get plenty of sunlight. Every night I put a pasteboard box cover over the apple so the dew or rain wouldn't unstick the film, and 3 weeks later I had a nice red apple with a perfect picture of a ship printed right into the peeling. Later I improved the process by wrapping black silk around the growing fruit to keep the skin sensitive. And I found by pasting on paper letters and cutout designs, I could print decorative borders on the pictures of babies, pretty girls, ships, and lighthouses. You can make distinctive, though perishable, birthday gifts by attaching gummed labels or letters to ripening fruit. And I've seen cutout silhouettes used to produce a light green profile on a dark red apple. If your youngsters try this, see that they experiment with apples growing on the lower limbs. And fruit that faces the east ripens and prints the fastest. I'll admit it took over 3 weeks to print a picture on an apple and a lot of tree climbing. But I got first prize in Class G of the exhibits of unusual fruit. Runners-up in that class were pumpkins with the grower's name in raised letters, multicolored gourds, and giant squash fed through a tube with buttermilk. Some of you may remember the wonderful exhibits of fruit and vegetables Dr. Walter G. Kendall of Quincy used to have at the horticultural shows, especially his grapes, which included all the American varieties and several imported from Europe, grown out of doors for the first time successfully. Dr. Kendall confided to me, the secret in growing those grapes is terrific pruning. I don't tend to raise just a lot of leaves. I raise grapes. And every fall, I take the vines from the trellis and bury them in the ground in a long trench. One of Doc's best tricks was grafting a tomato vine onto a potato plant, and he lugged the whole business into Horticultural Hall, where the bug-eyed public could see tomatoes growing above the ground and potatoes in the earth underneath. Oh, I tell you, there were lots of things to look at the country fairs in the old days. And best of all was the balloon ascension, which I'm sorry to say they don't have anymore. It used to cost us kids 25 cents to get in when the doors were opened in the afternoon. But if a boy had been running in and out all morning and just happened to be upstairs when the doors opened, nobody noticed. And while you could get a snack of cold ham and potato salad, or a nice brown chicken leg with a hunk of dressing and a cucumber pickle, and warm apple pie with a wedge of cheese and a cup of coffee and some donuts for 35 cents, a smart boy could earn his dinner just by being helpful. Running errands, that is. Every afternoon, the proud exhibitors would come into the hall before the afternoon show opened and rearrange their plates of prize fruit and vegetables. If a single spot showed up overnight on the ripe peaches or plums, or a beautiful bunch of grapes had lost its bloom, they were laid aside to be replaced with fresh ones. And you can guess who the boy was who volunteered to get rid of all that luscious fruit. I can still remember the taste of those wonderful, juicy Bartlett pears and pale yellow porter apples. But best of all were the big, red-ripe tomatoes, eaten with a dash of salt, and the crusty brown heel of Aunt Liz's loaf of homemade Graham nut bread. There's nothing that grows in a garden that can equal a dead-ripe tomato right off the vines in September. And when we went up to Kennebunkport to see Henry Gross do his scientific dowsing at Kenneth Roberts' place, I couldn't keep my eyes off Ken's tomato plants. At first glance, I thought they were lilac bushes. But they were tomatoes, all right, and they were climbing the roof of the Roberts porch. Several of the biggest and reddest ones were lolling lazily in the gutter pipe. I'm not kidding. Kenneth Roberts had tomato plants 10 feet high. They're probably higher by this time. You may have read how he does it in the Sunday Herald. Each spring, he digs a series of 2-foot holes in front of a high stone wall. He places a foot or so of peat moss in the bottom, then lays in a length of iron pipe with a bottom end resting on the peat moss. A 10-foot cedar pole is then wedged against the wall, earth is shoveled in, and the tomato plant is set out and tied securely to the cedar pole. Once a day, he waters the plants at 3 points. One around the base of the stone wall, 2 around the roots, and 3 down the pipe, which keeps the peat moss underground always moist. It's this underground watering, he says, that does the trick. He pinches off the suckers, and as fast as the plants start to grow, he restricts them to 3 sturdy stalks. Well, sir, I couldn't keep my mind off Ken Roberts' rooftop tomatoes. And when we moved to Beverly Farms, I decided to have tomatoes growing around our chimney. But when I started to spade up the clay bank between our breezeway and garage, I figured I'd do better to make bricks or go into the pottery business. For the soil we have is a far, far cry from the rich red soil of Kennebunkport. However, I bought 12 tomato plants last spring and set 8 of them between the beans, lettuce, and Swiss chard. The other 4 I saved for my experimental purposes. I dug the holes, put in the peat moss, wet it down, set the pipes, and then realized I didn't have any cedar poles. Up country, when we wanted bean poles, we took the hatchet and cut a load. On our land, or the neighbor's, or alongside the road. Slim birches, wild cherry, young maples, any old thing. And if we wanted cedar poles, there were always plenty of cedars over in the bog. And any kid in the neighborhood would be tickled pink to cut and deliver a load of poles for 2 cents apiece. But times have changed since Hannah died. And the 6 poles I finally found, scrawny and crooked, cost me 90 cents. I couldn't help thinking of the woodlot Father had over in the bog, which I gave away rather than pay taxes on it. There must have been 1 million poles in that swamp, and now I learn that ordinary bean poles bring $1.80 a dozen. Well, after I carefully set out my 4 plants, I tied them up with strips of soft cotton cloth, poured the prescribed amount of water down the pipe, then waited and watched for the first yellow blossom. Every morning, even before I had my coffee, I'd dash out to look at my skyscraper tomato vines. I watered them faithfully every afternoon, and then every night before going to bed, I went out with flashlight and rotenone to see if they'd grown any or if anything was pestering them. I pinched on the lower leaves, dusted the ants, and as the vines began to climb, I tied them up with gauze bandages. They grew all right, but compared to the other plants, which were now covered with buds, blossoms, bugs, and all the things I have, they were miserable failures. When my Kenneth Roberts experimental specimens were as high as the breezeway windows, and no buds had appeared, I called in my neighbor, Merton Burbank Barden, who can make African violet and ice. He winked at Alice and said, "Blackie, you watch 'em too much. Tomatoes are sensitive and bashful. They ain't going to blossom with you staring at 'em all the time. Leave 'em alone for a week. Go away someplace. They'll come along." So we went away. But all I kept worrying for fear the wind would knock 'em over, the worms would eat 'em, or they'd dry up. But by golly, when we got back, the vines looked mighty flourishing, except they didn't have any tomatoes. Mr. Barden came over and said, "The only trouble with those tomatoes is lack of morning sunshine." And jerking his bright green thumb at the other plants, he said, "Look at those. They're doing all right because they get morning light, while these in the shade of your garage are spindly. 1 hour of morning sun, Barden, is worth 5 hours of afternoon light." I'd like to know if you gardeners agree with this. Anyway, all this is a lot of fun. These experiments will keep the youngsters busy and happy. Well, 2 weeks ago, we received a letter from a listener up in New Hampshire. He closed a clipping from a farm journal, and he wrote on the edge of the clipping, "Is this possible? I don't believe it." Well, the clipping was about a man who for many years has been winning prizes for the giant squash he raises. And the article states, "The biggest squash won first prize for size at the World's Fair, tipping the scales at 384 pounds. Now, I don't wonder, my listener. I telephoned Malcolm McCormick up at WBZ and asked him what he thought about it. Max said, "Well, I'm not going out on a limb and say it never happened, because you can do some wonderful things with proper soil and the right conditions." And he added, "I've raised muskmelons that weighs 14 pounds, and that's pretty good for this neck of the woods. So I'm wondering if the story is true. Did you ever hear or see a 385-pound squash? The man who allegedly raised this mammoth vegetable says his soil is gravelly with a 16-inch layer of clay loam on top. Around the 1st of April, he digs a big pit and fills it with a super-rich mixture of manure. As soon as the seeds sprout and start to run, he adds a couple of bushels of hen dressing. Then he puts down a mulch of clean straw for the vines to crawl over, tying them to stakes so they won't thrash round in the wind and rain. All the blossoms that come before July, he pinches off. After that, he lets them bloom for 2 weeks. But if the weather is lowery and the morning's so damp and dark the bees can't work, he cuts the blossoms open and does his own pollinating, rubbing the stamen of one flower against the inside of the blossoms. When the tiny squash begin to form, he leaves three, cutting off all the others, and he pinches the ends of the vines twice a week. Later, he trims off everything except the one squash he intends to grow big. The old trick of feeding milk through the vine produces pygmies compared to these. This man says the secret of his success lies in the fact that from August on, he literally stuffs his plant with rich plant food in the form of liquid fertilizer. Also, he gives them a tremendous amount of water, but he has to be careful not to rot the roots. Of course, these giant vegetables aren't good for anything except for exhibition purposes or feeding the pigs. But he says his boys have a lot of fun watching them grow, and a bright green squash weighing over 300 pounds does attract a lot of attention. With vegetables as high-priced as they are these days, the same amount of time put into tomatoes would pay off handsomely. For instance, besides having all the red ripe tomatoes they can eat raw, Mr. and Mrs. Kenneth Roberts had on their pantry shelves last October the 15th the following tempting display. 15 quarts of Ken's own brand of tomato ketchup, 36 jars of Mrs. Roberts' stewed tomatoes, and 80 quarts of tomato relish and pickles. And still clinging to the 10-foot vines were enough green tomatoes to make 20 additional jars of green tomato pickles. And Ken told us proudly, we'll have enough ripe ones coming along to last the family table through the month of November. Mr. Roberts keeps an accurate account of his agricultural endeavors, and his records for 5 years show that his high-growing tomatoes average 4 to a pound, with a great many weighing over a pound. And listen to this. From those 12 original tomato plants, he gets 120 tomatoes to the vine, which times 12 furnishes him with 1,440 tomatoes. And that's good going. If you have produced more than 120 tomatoes to the vine, or know of anyone who has raised a squash that weighed over 300 pounds, I'd like to know about it.